Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. Have you ever Googled ridiculous national park reviews? If not, do it. You are going to have a really great laugh. I recently saw one for Grand Canyon National Park, and the reviewer wrote, "Whoopity-doo, Grand Canyon, you're a giant hole." Oh my God, what did they think the two words Grand and Canyon meant? Well, let me tell you, the stupid Grand Canyon National Park is absolutely breathtaking at every turn. The Grand Canyon was designated as a national park in 1919 and then designated as a World Heritage Site in 1979. And then in 2019, it earned its status as an international dark sky park. It's 278 miles long and 18 miles wide at its widest. And as for the depth, it's not the deepest canyon in the United States, but I'll tell you, 1 mile deep is not too shabby. The oldest human artifacts in the park date back to 12,000 years ago, with over 3,000 ancestral sites documented. And today, it's home to 11 federally recognized tribes. And did you know there are over 1,000 caves in the Grand Canyon? These caves led to a big hoax in 1909. The Arizona Gazette had reported that archaeologists from the Smithsonian had discovered traces of an ancient Tibetan or Egyptian civilization in an underground tunnel in the canyon. Now, the Smithsonian denied the story, claiming they had no knowledge of the archaeologists named in the article. But to this day, as these things tend to go, conspiracy theorists still believe this may have been a government cover-up. It's difficult to convey the grandeur of the Grand Canyon. Yet in the same way the senses can feel overwhelming awe in looking at this beautiful canyon, another deeply awe-inspiring experience will welcome you at night, and that's the night sky. There are few places left in our country where you can still look up at the night and see the structure of the Milky Way. The night sky is so pristine at the Grand Canyon that on a moonless night, the Milky Way actually casts a shadow. I have two guests on this episode. First is Ranger Raider Lane, who works at Grand Canyon National Park. And then we're going to chat with Tony Barnini from Clear Sky Resorts near the park. I'll introduce you to Tony later, but first, let's meet Ranger Raider Lane. Raider has been an interpretive park ranger at Grand Canyon since 2010, and he helps visitors connect both emotionally and intellectually with the night sky through formal talks, digital media, and outreach. He also manages the park's Dark Sky program, and his management of this program helped the park earn the International Dark Sky Place of the Year Award in 2019. He was also the recipient of the National Park Service's National Freeman Tilden Award for his interpretive work on night skies. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Ranger Raider Lane. Well, Ranger Raider Lane, thank you for joining me on the Night Sky Tours podcast to talk about the amazing Grand Canyon.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So I know that the Grand Canyon is an international dark sky park. And when did that happen? When did you guys get that certification?
Well, the process began back in 2013. I mean, the main catalyst was a healthy donation from the Joe Orr Family Foundation to our nonprofit partner, Grand Canyon Conservancy. There have been people like our night skies, our Natural Sounds and Night Skies Division of the National Park Service, and many night sky rangers much earlier than that, in the early 2007, 2008 era, who were taking initial night sky measurements and things like that of the park. But it was really 2013 that we hired a night skies inventory specialist to come and inventory all the lights in the park. That was about 2013 to 2014. And in 2016, we received provisional international dark sky status, which gave this park the leverage over 3 years to finish the process. And we were able to do that in June of 2019. And we needed that provisional status because this was a big ship to turn. I mean, it was unprecedented in scale. We astonishingly inventoried 5,094 lights in this park.
Really? I would never, ever have guessed there would be that many lights there. That's crazy. Wow.
It was a massive undertaking. I mean, this is one of the only national parks in the entire country with a K-12 school inside its borders. So it's sort of a mix between a dark sky park and a dark sky community in many ways. And so we have maintained this large infrastructure, which came complete with 5,094 lights, 34% of so or which were already night sky friendly. So all told, from that 2016 to 2019 period, we had to actively retrofit well over 1,500 lights in the park just to get to that 67% initial bar that you have to reach to become an international dark sky park. And now we're working on that 90% qualification and then eventually to our 100% qualification. So that was the main necessity for that provisional international dark sky park status that led into our dark sky park status in 2019.
I want people who have never been there, or especially haven't been there at night, to give them something to compare to. You've been to Phoenix. Phoenix is a major metro city. It's not Los Angeles. It's not Chicago, but it is a big city and puts out a lot of light pollution. So for comparison, if somebody were in Phoenix, where maybe they would look out up at night and see, I don't know, maybe 30 stars, what's going to be the difference when they go to Grand Canyon at night?
Like you said, in the magnitude of the light pollution problem is really highlighted when you compare places like Phoenix to the Grand Canyon. Whereas in places like Phoenix, as you say, you can maybe see 30 stars, 30 of the brightest stars, if you're lucky, throughout an evening. I mean, and at any given moment, there might be a time where you see only 4 or 5 stars, depending on where you're at. Whereas at Grand Canyon on a moonless summer night, we're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 stars. So the difference is staggering. The scale that people use to sort of give you a sense that this is a dark sky is the ability, for example, to see the Milky Way. And, you know, the Milky Way has long disappeared from places like Phoenix. You can clearly see the Milky Way here, but the truth is, I like to even go a little bit farther. There is a whole realm of delicate celestial phenomena that we lose well before the Milky Way disappears. And things like, you know, the zodiacal light and the Gegenschein and very faint celestial phenomena like the Andromeda Galaxy and nebulas and clusters. These things disappear upon the thinnest veil of light pollution. And here at Grand Canyon, that's preserved. That's preserved. The Milky Way is preserved. Thousands of stars are preserved. And we use that subjective scale, of course, the Bortle scale, to determine the quality of our night skies. Bortle 9 being you're at downtown Phoenix or you're, you know, some or downtown Las Vegas, say, as the worst example. And Bortle 1, you are in the middle of the Pacific Ocean or high atop a mountain. And it's basically a dichotomous key, right? You ask a series of questions from Bortle 9 to Bortle 1, getting increasingly darker as you ask more questions. Well, once you get down to the Bortle 2 and Bortle 1, you start asking some pretty unfamiliar questions to most people nowadays. And it's a reflection of just how dark things can actually be. And in Bortle 2, you start asking questions like, does the center of the Milky Way galaxy show detailed structure? And, you know, on a moonless summer night, you can go out and actually see the anatomy of the Milky Way. And that's something that most people can't see the Milky Way at all anymore. Once you get to Borda 1, you know, it's asking the question, on a moonless summer night, is the center of the Milky Way galaxy bright enough to cast your shadow? And that there, to me, just completely exposes the situation we find ourselves in with respect to the threats of light pollution today. That's something that we should all be able to experience. And for more than 80% of people today, we can't even see the Milky Way, let alone enjoy some of these, the beautiful phenomena that come out from it.
So what is Grand Canyon on the Bortle scale?
On the Bortle scale, Grand Canyon, somewhere between a 2 and a 1, depending on where you find yourself. We're at 1.2 million acres. So depending if you're far to the west, far to the east, if you're down into the canyon, certain places we've been able to say we're Bortle 1. Most places we are a Bortle 2 at this point. And so I think on the International Dark Sky Association's website, we're technically classed as a Bortle 2 when taking the median of our measurements.
And so there just really aren't very many places left in our country where people can even experience that. And then, of course, the grandeur of the Grand Canyon during day, you know, that's so amazing. So you've mentioned about how there's a school, a K-12 school there, and that's because you still have the ancestors of the ancient indigenous people who've always lived there. And so I kind of want to ask a little bit about this. First of all, to share with our listeners who the indigenous people are that live there, and anything you can share with us about their relationship with the night sky, whether past or present.
Well, that's right. We have this park has 11 traditionally affiliated tribes that are still very much intimately connected with this landscape to this day. In terms of cultural astronomy, which is sort of the realm we're getting into here, this region, Grand Canyon region, is one of the most complex, complete, and robust in that field of cultural astronomy. When we break down cultural astronomy to archaeoastronomy and ethnoastronomy, you know, the astronomies of ancient peoples here who might be considered the archaic peoples and the ancestral Puebloans, who then descended down to contemporary peoples, particularly from the ancestral Puebloans, the Hopi and the Zuni to this day. We maintain an incredibly rich, active cultural astronomy in this region that's unparalleled throughout the rest of the world. So there are 11 traditionally affiliated tribes. Many people might have heard of people like the Diné, the Navajo people, the Hopi people, the Ashiwi people, otherwise known as the Zuni people, the Havasupai, the Hualapai, the Yavapai Apache, several bands of Paiute peoples on the North Rim, all have their own deep connection with the night skies here. And that's one of the joys of astronomy in my mind is understanding that we're all looking at the same exact set of stars and skies, but we're all interpreting it in myriad different ways. And it's just a beautiful expression of culture that we're also preserving in the night sky. So I could go on for hours about the specifics and the intricacies of the cultural astronomy of the Grand Canyon region, but I'll just start with, you know, for example, the Diné people, the Navajo people of Grand Canyon region, maintain a constellation canon that is as robust and complete and as beautiful as the traditional Greek canon that, you know, Western science uses to this day. And there's very specific reasons for that. You know, the Diné maintain a very robust constellation canon over, say, the Hopi or the Zuni, who may be more interested in the rising and setting of the sun and the moon, for example. And that's all based on their history of how their people operate on the landscape. I mean, the Hopi and the Zuni people are more sedentary peoples, agriculturalists who are able to look upon the horizon line and watch the rising and the setting of the moon to create calendars for ceremonial and agricultural purposes. Whereas the Diné people have a semi-recent history of nomadicism and maintain a culture today that involves small communities spread over vast amounts of land. And so maintaining shepherding and cattle ranching and things like this means that you're going to be moving across the landscape quite a bit more than, say, the Hopi or the Zuni people. And so that movement across the landscape requires one to reckon time in a slightly different way. And in this particular way, the Diné people can use, for example, the heliacal rising of stars. You know, you can watch a star rise right before the sun rises in the morning. And the first sighting of that star in the season enables you to tell the time of year independent of your latitude. So wherever you find yourself, you can still tell the time of the year. And so many scholars think, and many of these scholars are coming straight out of Diné culture, David Begay and Nancy Maryboy, for example, who are the authors of Sharing the Skies, suggest that that robust constellation canon may have come about because of that history of moving across the landscape, more so than tribes that may have been more sedentary in nature.
I love all that stuff. Do they ever come and do presentations at the park about these things?
Whenever we can, we will have First Voices come and speak about this. When people aren't available, us park rangers do our best to talk about this stuff. But for example, this year at our Grand Canyon Star Party, which is June 10th through the 17th this year, we'll have several of our eight nights of special guest speakers, and several of them are going to be representatives of many of the tribes here to talk specifically about this type of thing to the extent that they are able to, because in many of these cultures, they're not encouraged to talk about this type of stuff, particularly constellation stories and mythologies in the summertime. These are things that are reserved for the winter time. And so to the extent they can.
That's common in a lot of cultures. You know, I've talked to people from the Crows, people, you know, the Aboriginal cultures in Australia, a lot of them have that same thing in their culture. And I find it really fascinating, actually.
It's totally fascinating. And I like to call this little niche field comparative ethnoastronomy. And I'm not sure it's an actual field yet, but it is looking at cultures sort of independent of themselves or related to each other and seeing how their astronomies differ or are similar. And you're right, there's some universals there where talking about constellations in the wintertime seems to be a trend that we find across cultures. Another interesting one is, you know, the identification of certain constellations as certain beings, you know, like famously Orion, you know, is depicted as a hunter in cultures independent of themselves across oceans from each other. And that is just a fascinating aspect of cultural astronomy that merits much more exploring.
What kind of night sky events do you guys host at the park throughout the year? I know you just mentioned your big 8-day star party in the summer, but I know you guys do other things. What else? And are they limited to the South Rim, or do you do them at the North Rim as well?
We have, of course, the Grand Canyon Star Party. It's been going on for 33 years. So this will be the 33rd annual Grand Canyon Star Party, an 8-night event that always happens in June. That is our flagship event. We have thousands of people come, over 100 astronomers come and dedicate 8 nights of their time. We have 50 to 70 telescopes set up every night, special guest speakers, night sky photography workshops, constellation talks. It's one of the largest night sky festivals in the National Park Service and indeed the country. So that happens in June. And then around that, we have several events through the year, one of which is a program called the Astronomer in Residence Program, where we invite amateur and professional astronomers, scientists, dark sky advocates, even writers and artists and things like this to focus their discipline and share their knowledge under one of the most pristine night skies in the United States. And this is a program that's supported by the Grand Canyon Conservancy, our nonprofit partner. And so we have these astronomers come and spend 4 to 6 weeks at the park being inspired by the dark night skies for their own work, but then also sharing their knowledge with the public through public programs, through creating artwork, through all sorts of mediums. Park rangers give constellation talks, full moon walks, telescope viewing sessions as we can throughout the year. And we have several other exciting sort of programs that fall under our larger dark sky outreach program that we're hoping to implement here in the near future, things like astronomy volunteers and things like this. So we're hoping to make our calendar much more filled with night sky programming, even more so than it already is in the near future.
So you've created this short documentary. I've seen it a couple of different times that I believe you made during one of those star parties. Tell the listeners about that, because the first, okay, let me just qualify this. I'm the kind of person that I rarely cry, but this brought tears to my eyes when I watched this, both times that I watched it. So share with us a little about that.
Well, thanks so much. That's really nice to hear. We in the Park Service have been experimenting with a style of interpretation known as audience-centered experiences. And we're really trying to think of ways to include visitors into the conversation of their own national parks when it comes to protecting this place. And so as the Dark Skies coordinator, I was trying to think how I can connect people on a more human level and emotional level to the night skies. I think a lot of our awe and wonder about the night skies is grounded in cultural understandings, in emotional understandings. And so that's something we wanted to explore. And so at the Grand Canyon Star Party for the last few star parties, we've set up experimental installations, what we call in the field, we call them pop-ups, where visitors are supposed to stumble upon these art installations and are invited to participate. So for the first year, we set up outside a vintage cassette recorder and had people come upon that. And next to the cassette recorder was a question that was posed to the visitors. And that particular one was, you know, the year is 2218, 200 years in the future. And you've been sent back to 2018, for example, to come look up at these pristine night skies that no longer exist in 2218. And so what is your message to your people of the future about what they're missing essentially when it comes to these night skies? And so that was a really fun sci-fi type of question that we asked people, and it got incredible responses, much more than we thought it was going to get. And so that inspired us to start thinking of different ways to engage. And I think after setting up a wildlife camera down at Phantom Ranch for one of our films and asking people, you know, based off a Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, you know, how would you want to remember the stars? If this were the last night in 1,000 years that you could see the stars, how would you want to remember them? You know, after doing that project and seeing the success there, we decided to go a little bit deeper. And in 2019, we installed an old rotary phone outside of in the telescope lot of the Grand Canyon Star Party and asked people to look up, dial this number that we gave them. And the message that they received there asked them to look up at the night sky and pick out a star and talk to that star as if it were somebody that you loved who you've lost. As a lot of cultures do believe that when their loved ones pass away, they become stars. We experimented with that idea, and the reactions were profound. They were deep. They were highly emotional. And I did my best to respect as much as I could the sincere responses that visitors were giving to this question. And when we compiled those all together and juxtaposed them to old footage of visitors visiting the Grand Canyon and enjoying their loved ones here at the park, it made for an incredibly emotional video. And it's since become pretty successful in that small realm of interpretation in the national parks. And We're just trying to think of ways that we can continue to do these type of things because it evidently had a strong impact on those who participated and then those who would watch it as well.
And I'm going to put a link to that video in the show notes because I want people to go click on that and watch it. It was excellent. Very, very well done.
Thank you.
You had mentioned earlier when we first started talking about how sometimes the thinnest veil of light pollution can wash away not just the Milky Way, but other things. And so this takes me back to the first time it's not that you and I met necessarily, but I got to participate in a laser tour that you did of the night sky at Tonto National Monument here in Arizona. And it was the first time I saw Andromeda with the naked eye. You were showing us how to see it and how to use our averted vision so that we could see it. And I was absolutely gobsmacked that I was looking at a freaking galaxy with my naked eye. I couldn't believe it. It was so cool. But one of the things that really stood out to me about the way you led that stargazing experience was that you took most of the time sharing stories about the constellations, not, you know, oh, this one's this many light years away and blah, blah, blah. It, you know, those things tend to excite some people, but not very many. And it was the star stories that stuck in my head and the way you just told the story all the way across the constellations. And so I'm just really curious, I think more for me, I hope the listeners enjoy the answer too, but like what led you to start doing stargazing tours that way with the stories?
Well, I think you can, and thank you for all that. The joy about stargazing for me is being able to look at these constellations through several different lenses. I mean, you can go through the night sky and look at it through that scientific lens. If you're feeling more inquisitive and empirical in that sense, more naturalist, you can go and look at it through the naturalist and the scientific lens. You can go back and you can look at it through the history of astronomy and how these constellations came to be canonized into our society. You can look at the etymology of star names and see how they've trickled down through generations of people transliterating them through manuscripts and things like this. You can look at the mythologies and the stories. And again, it's just a testament to how much is written into the night sky culturally that is worth preserving. But I think I tend to gravitate a little bit more, as you say, towards the stories and really the history and the etymologies of the star names. And I think, again, it comes back to what I said earlier, which is I really do think a big portion of our awe and wonder about the night skies is dependent and informed by cultural understandings. You know, we're looking at the greatest inkblot test that has ever existed in time and space. I mean, through millennia, people have been looking at this same exact sky, and we've been interpreting it in many different ways and often using our local environment and our local customs as lenses through which we interpret the night skies. And so when you look up, you're just looking at this aggregate expression of humanity in the skies. And it is so incredibly rich that you have almost no choice but to include a few stories about the skies because they're so rich, so enduring, and in many traditions, so beautiful and so helpful to our well-being. And so that's, I think, why I tend to gravitate towards the stories and the history a little bit more than the science, which of course I absolutely love as well. But I agree, people tend to cling a little bit more to the human side of the stars.
And I think that's what they go home and remember. You know, they might not remember how many light years Betelgeuse is away or what kind of star it is, but they'll remember the story you told them about Orion.
That's absolutely awesome. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, Rader, how can people learn more about the Grand Canyon and also about the night sky programs that you guys do there?
Well, you can follow us on our social media channels, of course. We're on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and YouTube. So we have those platforms. We also have our park website, which is very helpful for planning your visit, things like that. There's a handy app in that has been released by the National Park Service as a whole, the National Park Service app. And if you download that, then it's sort of standardized for every single national park. So you can go click on Grand Canyon, and we've populated that with all sorts of calendars and events and ways to experience the park. So I would suggest those for pre-planning and while you're on site. But then coming up to us at the visitor center when you get here and just talking to a park ranger about what type of opportunities that we offer while you're on site here. If you want to get a little bit more pre-planning in as well, we do have a night skies page on our Grand Canyon webpage. And that has all these, that's the umbrella for all these programs that I was talking about, the Astronomer in Residence program, the Grand Canyon Star Party, all the links to the videos and things we've been discussing. So that's sort of our landing page for all things night skies, if you're interested in learning more about our incredible resource of the night skies here.
Great. I will put all of that, all of those links into the show notes so people can, you know, take the easy way out, go just click on them and take you right to all of that stuff. So Raider, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this. This is such an amazing place for people to go. And I think a lot of people don't realize there's a saying, and I don't know if it's common among all the national parks or just Grand Canyon, of half the park is after dark.
Half the park is after dark. And I always like to say, when it comes to Grand Canyon, you know, there's no place else on nocturnal earth where you can stand between so much deep time revealed beneath you and revealed above you. It's a transcending experience to be able to come here and enjoy the deep time of the Grand Canyon geology by day. And then it's deep time of its night skies at night. So please do come out and enjoy this, and come say hi to me if you do.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Vicki.
One upside to social media that I've experienced over and over is the way it has acquainted me with outstanding dark sky places and stargazing experiences around the world. This is how I eventually connected to our next guest. Tony Barnini is the general manager of Clear Sky Resorts, which is located just 20 minutes from the Grand Canyon. Instagram's algorithms decided I should see posts from this spectacular resort. So when I finally decided to check it out, I got really excited. They hadn't actually officially opened for business at that time. So it's really been fun for me to watch the business open and grow in such a short time through their social media feed. Astrotourism is one of the fastest growing segments in the tourism industry. And this place gives people like you and me an amazing way to experience the night sky. I chatted with Tony Barnini about Clear Sky Resorts, and I loved his enthusiasm for wanting to share this place with visitors. Tony had a 17-year career in the Northeast beauty industry before deciding to pursue a career in national parks tourism. This is his second year working at the property, and he loves helping people reconnect with the world and the universe around them. I'm going to let Tony spill the beans about what makes Clear Sky Resorts so special and why you're going to want to make reservations early. Please welcome to the podcast, Tony Barnini.
Tony, thank you for joining me on the Night Sky Tours podcast to talk about your really cool place called the Clear Sky Resort. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, and thank you for having me.
So Clear Sky Resort is a very unique place, and I'd like for you to share with everybody what makes it so unique.
So you mean like aside from us being like a 45 dome geodesic dome resort or what?
Right. That's so cool. Like, yeah. I don't think that most people have ever stayed in one. So tell us a little bit about that.
So Clear Sky is unique on a whole bunch of different levels. You know, we're not your traditional brick and mortar resort. We are more of a glamping sort of excursion. We have 45 rentable domes on site, and they're all different themed as well. So, you know, it's a little bit of something for everybody. It's a place to let your imagination wander a bit.
When I first came across you, I think on Instagram, the first themed room I saw was, I think it was Pac-Man, like, you know, the Pac-Man game thing. And I was like, what the heck? Oh my God, my husband wants to stay here.
That is like, so our 80s video game dome is probably one of our number one selling domes. I still can't stand myself when I walk in it because it's just like everything from my childhood, you know, kind of popping out at you. So it's a surreal experience for sure.
What are some of the themes?
So we have a unicorn and rainbows theme that we're introducing this year. That will just be fun. And it's like every child's sort of like dream rainbow unicorn theme. That one's not, we don't have pictures up of that one yet because we're redesigning right now, which is cool. We have our standard Grand Canyon dome, which basically has like Grand Canyon wallpaper and our standard furniture in it. Those domes can house up to 5 people in them. So there's 3 beds. There's 2 queens and then 1 twin. And those are also lofted rooms. We even have a secret agent dome, which is kind of inspired by your favorite secret agent out there. And that one's pretty neat. It has a British phone booth in it and stuff like that as well. Stairway to the Stars is another themed dome, which has a suspended bed from the ceiling, which is pretty much right underneath your window to look out at the night sky.
That sounds awesome. So when people stay in a dome, if they've never stayed in one before, what can they expect and what kind of amenities will they have inside the dome?
I think everybody expects something a little bit different, but there's still that major wow factor when they walk into it. I mean, it was so awesome to just see the expressions on people's faces as we brought them into the domes. Even the welcome dome, when you show up and go to check in, people usually walk in very confused at first because you don't know where you just went, you know? And I love the question, where are we? We usually get, where are we? You know, they're just kind of like looking all around. And I usually just say, you're here. You're here. You've arrived. The amenities in the domes, pretty much all the same. You know, furniture obviously changes with the theme, but you can always expect our full bathroom. Our bathroom's kind of broken up into 2 sections. So there's a sink, vanity, and then a place to hang your clothes. We also have a little mini fridge there. And then when you walk into the greater part of the bathroom, there is a glass surround shower with reinforced feature, and then toilet.
And the coolest thing about staying in these, because you guys are located in an unbelievable area for stargazing, is that, what is it? Is it half of the dome or a third of the dome is all clear, so you can lay in bed and literally go to sleep under the stars?
Yeah, so we have these huge panoramic windows in all of our domes. And I should mention before that some of them are different sizes. We do have smaller, like just 2-person domes as well. But the window's just massive. It's basically one whole wall in your dome. And then above every bed at the top of every single one of our domes, we do have windows there as well with a sunshade. So, and it's all remote control operated. So as long as you turn off all the lights, you can lay in bed and see the stars.
That's so cool. It's hard to find an experience like that where you can lay in bed and actually look at the stars. And your property is so cool. When I see the pictures, like, you know, zoomed out pictures of your property, it's really cool. And so what else can people expect in terms of amenities around the property?
So we have a little bit of everything. The only thing we don't have is a pool. And let's be honest, when you have the night sky, who needs the pool, right?
It'd you be know, cold anyway.
Yeah, it'd be way too cold. And everybody has a pool. What you can expect, we have live entertainment on property. We have a food truck with an amazing menu for the area. Everything's made fresh daily. And we do breakfast and we do dinner as well. S'mores by the fireplace. We were actually expanding and getting more fireplaces this season, which is cool. We have a giant playground with a humongous bounce pillow, which is personally my favorite. It's just so stupid. It's so fun. We have a trike track, which is really great. Volleyball, tetherball. And then I think one of the coolest things, I mean, you can give a kid almost every single thing on earth and they're still going to want to play in the dirt. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? We have plenty of dirt. So it's just a fun, come as you are, no pressure property. And really the whole point of us in our mission is to just remove you from that world a little bit and just let your mind wander and enjoy where you are.
And then how far are you from the Grand Canyon? Because, of course, in this episode, we're talking all about the Grand Canyon. How far are you?
So we're about 26 miles south of the Grand Canyon. So you can expect like a 30 to 45 minute drive, depending on traffic to the gate. You know, you cannot see the Grand Canyon from our domes. We get that question a lot, you know, and I always try to tell people one of the coolest things about the canyon is you really can't see it until you're standing right next to it.
It's so true. That's great though, because I've had to stay at places that were pretty far away from the Grand Canyon because, you know, their lodge and anything that's closer can oftentimes fill up pretty quick. So a lot of times people are going to be driving a ways anyway. So why not stay somewhere super cool?
Well, you know, and yeah, we're cool. I love the property. I just think it's so interesting. I'm still, every single time I pull onto property, and I lived there all last season, but every time I pull onto property, I'm just still kind of hit with that, like, where exactly am I sort of feeling, that out of body experience you get. And it's the same type of thing that you get when you look up at the stars at night.
Yeah.
You know, I always love to tell our guests that we are in the middle of nowhere, but at the beginning of everything. And it's true. You can head to Flagstaff, which is 45 minutes in one direction. You can go to Williams and visit historic Route 66, or you can even just wander across the street and visit the Raptor Ranch and all of our little neighbors in that community.
Yeah, there is a lot to do in that area. And there's Barizona, you know, the Bear Place. Oh my gosh, there's just so much fun stuff. So when does your season open and close? Because I know you're not open year round.
Yeah, we're not. We're not permanent structures, so we can only be open for a certain amount of the year. Our season, this season for 2023, will be April 27th. That's our opening day. And then we will remain open until November 11th. And just a fair warning to anybody looking to book for the colder months, please bring a lot of good warm clothes with you. Because even though we're heated, it can still get a little cool at night.
Sure. And even if they're going to visit the Grand Canyon, it's going to be cold there too.
Absolutely.
How can people learn more about the Clear Sky Resort?
Well, one of the best ways is to follow us on social media. And we're Clear Sky Resorts pretty much on every platform. And if you want to book or you're interested in booking or you just want more pictures, then head over to our website, which is clearskyresorts.com. You can check out our property.
Thank you so much for sharing about this place. I hope people actually put this on their list of places to stay when they go to the Grand Canyon, because it's such an absolutely extraordinary experience to see the Grand Canyon during the day, to participate in their night sky programs by night. And then what better way to top it off by freaking sleeping under the stars?
It's a cool one. I really hope people book. We just have the best guests and we had so much fun last season. And we're just hoping for an even better, bigger, badder experience every single year. This one will be fun. And we have more star guides and tours on property as well.
Oh, that's great. I didn't realize that. And I know that Grand Canyon has their big annual star party coming up this summer too. So have you guys already booked up for that? Or
So I'm a sucker. I lived in Grand Canyon National Park for 4 years and I went every single year. And I'm still going to go this year. So that's one thing that I absolutely recommend to people all the time is that. And I think we're almost sold out for that weekend, unfortunately.
Okay. Wow.
Or that week. Yeah, that full week.
Sure. Yeah, because it's 8 days. Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Well, Tony, thank you for taking time to chat with us. And I'm really thrilled that we were able to share your place with people.
Thanks, Vicky. Come visit us.
I'm going to. Absolutely. You're not all that far away from me.
Good. Reach out to me.
When thinking about places with pristine dark skies and a clear view of the Milky Way overhead, you might wonder, how far can I actually see? It turns out we don't see so far during the daytime, even with the sun lighting everything up. It's only when it gets dark, and I mean really dark, that we can truly understand how far we can see. I've written about this in my article titled, Light, Darkness, and the Human Eye, How Far Can We See? In this article, I take you on a little journey to understand just how far we can see and why that knowledge makes light pollution feel a little more devastating. You can find a link to the article in the show notes or visit nightskytourist.com and click on the blog tab.
Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tourist Podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tourist Podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.